Random House Audio presents Defend the Realm, The Authorized History of MI5 by Christopher Andrew. Read for you by Robin Sachs. Foreword by the Director General of the Security Service. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to write a foreword for Christopher Andrew's Authorized History of the Security Service. Stephen Lander, Director General of the Service between 1996 and 2002, recognized that a history of the Security Service would be an appropriate way to mark our centenary in 2009, and he began the project of which this book is the outcome. Both his successor, Eliza Manningham Buller, and I have been closely involved in its development. We decided very early on that to generate the public understanding and support that is vital to the service's continued success, we needed to commission an open history for publication rather than a closed one for internal consumption. It was also important for the book to be written by an independent historian who could make objective judgments on the successes and failures of the service in its first 100 years. We've been fortunate in having in Professor Christopher Andrew an author with an exceptional understanding of the intelligence world, a great capacity to research and identify key material from the very large volumes available in our files, and the confidence to draw his own conclusions. I would like to thank him for the professionalism and dedication he has shown throughout the project. The Security Service is, of course, an organization much of whose work must remain secret. This is to protect those who share information with us and ensure that they and others will have the confidence to do so in the future, and to prevent those who seek to harm this country and its people from gaining information which might help them carry out their plans. Writing a history for publication which covers the work of the service up to the present day is therefore a considerable challenge, and one which I do not believe that any other major intelligence or security service anywhere in the world has attempted. But for me and for the previous DGs who have been involved in this project, it is a challenge worth attempting. The Security Service of 2009 is a much more open organization than that of 1909 or even 1980, when I first applied to join. This reflects the expectations of society at large that public institutions should be properly accountable. It also reflects the changing nature of the threats we face. For much of the first 80 years of its existence, the Security Service was concerned with various forms of foreign state espionage. This was and remains a vital area of our work, but in the last 20 years, terrorism has become the most significant threat with which we deal. The direct impact of terrorism on the life of the average resident of the UK is much greater than that of espionage or some of the other threats with which the service has dealt. It is therefore important that we as a service are as open and transparent as possible, within the constraints of what the law allows, because that openness, by supporting public confidence in us, helps us do our job of protecting national security. In the last 20 years, we have begun publicly to acknowledge the identity of the Director General of the service. We have moved to a system of recruitment of staff through open advertising. We've established a public website, and we have instituted a program of releasing some of our older records to the National Archives. These and other developments are a reflection of a commitment to being as open as we can about what we do, of which this history is the most recent and in many ways the most ambitious demonstration. Striking the balance in the text between openness and the protection of national security has been a complex and demanding exercise, requiring many hours of detailed discussion between Professor Andrew and members of the service, and an extensive clearance process involving other departments and agencies. The history as published includes some information that is embarrassing or uncomfortable to the service. Information has only been omitted if its disclosure would damage national security, or in a small number of cases if its publication would be inappropriate for wider public interest reasons. Inevitably, more material damaging to national security has been omitted from the more modern parts of the book. Given the sensitivity of the judgments concerning omissions on national security grounds, the principles which have governed our approach to the text are given in some detail on the service's website at www.mi5.gov.uk. forward slash output/centenary-history-policy-on-disclosure.html. In particular, we've ensured that everything included in the text is both consistent with the government's policy on neither confirm nor deny NCND, and at the same time necessary to meet our aims in publishing Professor Andrew's work. The consequence of this clearance process is that there is nothing in the book which could prejudice national security. The judgments and conclusions drawn by Professor Andrew in the history are his own, not those of the security service or the government as a whole. Giving Professor Andrew the independence to reach his own conclusions, however well or badly they reflected on the service, was a key element of the project. In writing the history, Professor Andrew has drawn not only on security service records, but also on a host of other material available to him. It should not therefore be assumed that his conclusions are based solely on material in our records, which is unavailable to the public. This book is not an official history within the terms of the government program of research and publication of official histories on a variety of subjects relating to government activity. I hope that you will enjoy the history and that you will consider, as I do, that it provides a striking new insight into an important element in our national life over the last century and into the work of the many dedicated members of the service whose contribution has been, and to a large degree will remain, unsung. Jonathan Evans. Preface. For most of its history, the Security Service, MI5, has seemed to outsiders a deeply mysterious organization. Successive governments intended it to be so. The service, like the rest of the intelligence community, was to stay as far from public view as possible. The historian Sir Michael Howard declared in 1985, "So far as official government policy is concerned, the British security and intelligence services do not exist. Enemy agents are found under gooseberry bushes, and intelligence is brought by the stalks." The past, as well as present, of the security service remained officially taboo. Even at the end of the Cold War, staff could scarcely have imagined that the service would mark its 100th birthday in 2009 by publishing this centenary history. The first century of the Security Service falls into six distinct periods, identified in the contents, which reflect its changing priorities. For 80 years, the service set out to defend the realm against alternately Germany and Russia and their supporters inside the United Kingdom. Before and during the two world wars, MI5's chief priority was to counter German intelligence operations. For most of the interwar years, and the whole of the Cold War by contrast, the service's main concerns were what it saw as the linked threats of Soviet espionage and communist subversion. Though MI5 comprehensively defeated the British operations of both Kaiser Wilhelm II's and Adolf Hitler's intelligence services, it found Soviet intelligence a more difficult opponent. Not until the mass expulsion of KGB and GRU, military intelligence, personnel from London in 1971, did the security service gain the upper hand. MI5's deputy head proudly declared on its 25th anniversary in 1934, "Our security service is more than national, it is imperial." During the quarter century after the Second World War, its officers and many other staff could expect to spend a quarter to a third of their careers in the Empire and Commonwealth. The service's overseas role adds another dimension to our understanding of British decolonization. Until the beginning of the Troubles in 1969, the service knew far less about Northern Ireland than about Anglophone Africa. It also had little experience of counterterrorism. As late as 1974, only 7.5% of the service's resources were devoted to counter-terrorist operations against both the IRA and international terrorist groups, whose emergence as a security threat nearly coincided with the start of the Troubles. Until 1992, the lead intelligence role in Britain against the IRA belonged not to the service, but to the special branch of the Metropolitan Police. The end of the Cold War and the disintegration of the Soviet Union transformed security service priorities.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?